Welcome to Radio Naturopath, the talk show about health and natural medicine. It's Wednesday, January 24th, 2022, live to be rebroadcast Wednesday, January 26th, 2022 on 91.7 FM WHUS Storch. Shout out to my friend Chris Green. It's his birthday on Wednesday. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician with my co-host Ron Meniza. We're coming to you live from beautiful Mansfield Hollow, Connecticut. Comment below to let us know you're here and ask questions. You can also email me at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to the show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org, iTunes, and Spotify. You can also check out my Facebook page, Twitter, and Instagram at FranStorchND. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. The information presented on this show should not be construed as medical advice or direction. If you are having a medical condition, please consult with your physician. Here's some stuff we do when the weather is bad. So we were talking about hunkering down last week. This came up on last week's show and we got curious about the origins of the term hunkering down. So Ben Zimmer wrote a great article in the Wall Street Journal that breaks down a bunch of weather terms, not just hunkering down, but a bunch of things. So I thought that was kind of interesting. So here's the stormy origins of hunker down. He wrote this like 4 years ago when Irma happened. Remember Hurricane Irma? It was a pretty nasty hurricane. It affected Florida a great deal. So whenever a hurricane strikes, people talk about hunkering down. Some of our hurricane lingo comes from old nautical expressions. For example, riding out the storm. That dates back to the 16th century as a way to describe a ship and its passengers withstanding nasty weather, also sheltering in place, which is a common order in emergency management, is much more recent, and that comes from the 1970s when it came on congressional hearings on civil defense in when there's nuclear fallout. You're supposed to shelter in place. But hunkering down, hunker, which we don't hear without down, it emerged in the Scots language in the 18th century. So that's the 1700s. It referred to squatting down on the balls of your feet, keeping low to the ground, but still ready to move if necessary. It comes from a Germanic root with descendants in other languages, all having to do with crouching. So when you're hunkering down, you're actually crouching. So if you're not, if you think you're in your house and you're just, you know, hanging out on the couch and watching football or whatever it is you enjoy watching while it's stormy out, you're not technically hunkering, but if you practice some yoga and do a squat, then you might be hunkering. So there's examples going back to the 1720s, hunkering down, also bunker down, which isn't related to hunker, but it is from Scottish too. It makes sense semantically, you know, in terms of words where you can imagine riding out a storm, which is from nautical lingo. And it's very popular. Bunkering down is popular in Australia. Bunker down is to find shelter against attack, whether the shelter is physical or metaphorical. We're picking it up too, and during Irma, Fort Lauderdale's fire rescue department said stay inside and bunker down. So that's interesting. So that was an interesting, so that's where bunkering down, riding out the storm. So there you go. So there's a few ideas about where hunkering down came from. So if you want to hunker down, you can still say it, because in common usage, it just means kind of you're going to stay home and you're not going to go very far. We hunker down, you know, because of COVID and Omicron and stuff. And what we mean is we're kind of staying home and we're not doing too much. We're not going out. Or if it's really stormy, we're staying in our house and hiding. And that's kind of how we use hunkering down, which is fine. All right. So there you go, hunkering down. And if you choose to hunker down in the next week or so, there is going to be some cold weather, possibly some more snowy weather tonight, tomorrow, and also Saturday. Maybe, you know, that's what they're predicting. And we know how the predictions may or may not go. So what can I say?
Good hunkering weather.
Yeah, hunkering weather. All right. Yeah. So we had a question from Eleanor. She wrote to me at radionaturopath@gmail.com. She was diagnosed with osteopenia and she's very physically active. She already is taking vitamin D3 and wanted to know if she ought to add calcium supplements. So the answer is, I don't know Eleanor, so I don't know what to tell her personally. It all depends on Eleanor. Now, this is just a question. So I have to obviously answer this generally. So what would be the answer to that? So what I do with people who are diagnosed with osteopenia, if they're diagnosed with osteopenia, I'm hoping that their doctors aren't already prescribing pharmaceuticals to increase bone density. Osteopenia means that your bone density is above standard deviation is 1.5 or above 1.5 away from normal. And if it's below 1.5, it's greater than 1.5, then you're diagnosed with osteoporosis. So if you have a reduced bone density, but it's not extreme, then that's diagnosed as osteopenia. Low bone density, osteoporosis means they're intimating that your bones are actually porous and could possibly break. The concern about low bone density is that you are at greater risk for fractures. All right, so anyway, so the thing is, so Eleanor says she's already taking vitamin D3. So what do you do with the vitamin D3? First of all, you need to know what dose the person is taking. I am not a fan of people taking vitamin D2. It's synthetic. It's not the form that our bodies make. And if you're going to take extra vitamin D3, you want it to be in the D3 form. And vitamin D is, you can make it from sunshine, but this time of year, you're probably not going to be outside long enough uncovered to make adequate vitamin D. So it's a good idea to take it internally. And most of my patients, I put them on vitamin D because most of my patients come in low. And we want to see people sitting at 50 to 70-ish nanograms per milliliter blood-wise for their vitamin D3 level. And most people come in low. So most people, I put them on anything, I put them on vitamin D. And people vary in their ability to absorb vitamin D. And when you see blood levels of vitamin D, people vary in what they come in at. And then I could put somebody on 3,000 IU of vitamin D a day, and their vitamin D is going to sit in the 40s. And I could put somebody else on 5,000 IU, and it jumps up to 75. People vary genetically in their ability to absorb vitamin D. There is a gene, the VDR gene, that has a couple of versions. And based on what version of vitamin D VDR you have, that affects how well you absorb your vitamin D. So everybody's dose of vitamin D needs to be tweaked. That's what I generally see. I need to take, I'm successfully, personally, I'm doing well with 3,000 IU a day with vitamin K2. I'm taking a bit of vitamin K2 with it, probably around 50 micrograms. So that is something that you do. You look at somebody's vitamin D. I don't always offer vitamin K2. If somebody's diagnosed with low bone density, I generally do can offer vitamin K2. So it depends on Eleanor's vitamin D level, how much vitamin D she should take. That needs to be tweaked, and she needs to talk to her doctor who should be looking at her vitamin D level. And if it doesn't go up to that 50 level on its own, she probably needs vitamin K2. The thing is, if her bone density is reduced, she probably should be taking K2 anyway. Why would you take vitamin D and K2? Well, because vitamin D, it helps to direct minerals into your bones and helps to strengthen your bones. It's hormonally based doing that. And vitamin K2 as well, also is a traffic director for calcium in particular, and it directs calcium into the bones and away from becoming just a calcification outside your body. It's a traffic director. It directs vitamin calcium to where it's supposed to go. So it's generally a good idea to take K2 with your vitamin D. If you take K2, you may not need to take as high a dose of vitamin K2. If Eleanor wanted to and discussed it with her naturopath or her physician, she could take a healthy calcium. There are various forms of calcium. I'm not a fan of calcium carbonate because calcium carbonate neutralizes stomach acid, and you need stomach acid to absorb calcium. So it doesn't make sense to take calcium carbonate, that's what Tums is. You take it to neutralize stomach acid. And besides that, Tums has coloring in it and has sugar sweeteners in it. So I'm not a big fan of it. But what I would like people to do, if they're going to take calcium, I want them to take, they don't need to take too much calcium. This depends on the person, but you want to be getting in from all sources around 12 to 1500 milligrams of calcium a day. You may not need that much if you're vitamin D sufficient, but in terms of supplements, I tend to recommend no more than 500 to 600 milligrams of calcium a day. And I like to see that in a very absorbable form. My favorites are citrate malate, also hydroxyapatite, which is the form that that calcium is in your bones. It's a matrix of minerals that calcium is involved in. And also calcium lactate. Calcium lactate is a really nice form. It's very easily absorbable. And so if somebody needs calcium, I'll tend to recommend those, and not at a super high dose. because I recommend them along with other things. My understanding is you should never take calcium without also taking magnesium. Magnesium is just as important in maintaining bone density and building bone as calcium is. And if you want your calcium to go where it's supposed to go and not go elsewhere and make calcifications, make bone spurs, make kidney stones. You want to have vitamin K2 on board and you want to have magnesium on board. Magnesium, one of the things that magnesium does, it helps to keep calcium in solution. We offer magnesium to people who have had kidney stones because it keeps calcium in solution, makes it less likely to precipitate out and cause calcifications. And as I said, it's part of the bony matrix and it has so many other health benefits too. So if you're looking at a bone density issue, it's a good idea to take magnesium as well. Obviously vitamin K2. I also like to recommend boron. Boron is a mineral that's really great for moderating hormones, especially female reproductive hormones, especially when we're postmenopausal. And it is also part of the bony matrix. And if you take a little bit of boron, that can also help maintain bone density. So At the least, I like to see people, if people are diagnosed with vitamin D2 or D3, I like to see people on vitamin D3, vitamin K2, calcium, magnesium, and boron. And beyond that, there are some other things that you can take to maintain bone density, depending on the person. If somebody just has osteopenia, I have to say that at that basic level, D3, K2, CalMag, and maybe boron, maybe not, if people take those supplements and they get weight-bearing exercise, generally, and without taking any pharmaceuticals, generally, when they go to their next bone density, their bone density has increased. And I've seen that without taking a pharmaceutical, that if you just simply D3, CalMag, K2, and maybe boron, and weight-bearing exercise. So that's, you know, doing some consistent yoga, doing some consistent resistance training with weights that includes lower body work with squats and stuff. If you do consistent yoga or Tai Chi or Qigong, you're going to be doing some squats anyway. So if you do those things consistently, then you're combined with the supplementation and combined with eating well. If you're going to be eating a ton of sugar, if you are inflamed in any way, if you're not eating a healthy diet, if you're not eating your fruits and vegetables and clean protein, if you're not getting adequate protein, that will lower your bone density because you need protein in order to build your bony matrix. It helps to support your bones and helps you to have healthy structure, a place for the minerals to go. So that's important too. So if you're eating an unhealthy diet, if you're eating too much sugar, if you're drinking too much alcohol, if you drink too much alcohol, like if you're a woman and you're drinking one or two glasses of wine a night, that could lower your bone density. Why? Because when you drink alcohol, alcohol takes up the resources of your liver. It makes it so that your liver can't manage your hormones as well. And it winds up ultimately lowering your estrogen status. And so you need some estrogen. If you're postmenopausal, you're getting your estrogen from your fat cells and from your adrenals. You're not getting it from your ovaries anymore. So if you're drinking too much alcohol and you're postmenopausal, that can lower your bone density too. So you want to be eating a healthy diet in addition to taking these supplements and getting your weight-bearing exercise. If you have an inflammatory condition, like if you have an autoimmune condition and it's not being treated, it needs to be treated. You need to get that inflammation down. And there's ways to do that naturopathically and there's ways to do that pharmaceutically. Naturopathically, if you have an autoimmune condition, again, we're going to pull out all the naturopathic stops. We're going to have you eat a healthy diet. We're going to have you get exercise. We're going to have you do restorative activities like yoga, Tai Chi, breathing, taking naps, being in nature. And we might have you take anti-inflammatory supplements. This is a place where curcumin is really nice because curcumin is a wonderful anti-inflammatory. It can lower NF-kappa beta, which increases your level of cytokines, a general inflammatory compound in your body. And curcumin also has phytoestrogen properties. So if you take enough curcumin, I'm discovering this with myself. I'm taking a higher dose of curcumin for inflammation, and I'm finding that I'm getting less night sweats. And that's just from taking curcumin. I was taking rhubarb extract for hot flashes, and I stopped taking it, and I'm taking this higher dose curcumin, and it's working better, I think, than this rhubarb extract I was taking. I haven't been taking, and I'm not taking black cohosh either. I'm consistently taking fish oil and black cumin seed oil, plus I'm taking this higher dose of curcumin, and it's helpful. So those are really helpful. And so all of those things, eating healthfully, avoiding inflammation, getting good rest, reducing stress, watching your sugar, watching your alcohol, watching your poor quality fats, like if you're going to the fast food, if you're going to the drive-thru and getting muffins, and you're getting hydrogenated fat, if you're eating too much deep fried stuff. I know this is, when is the Super Bowl, the next weekend, or is it 2 weeks?
It's February sometime.
Right, so it's probably the first weekend in February. But the playoffs are happening now. I'm hearing in the news is playoff. And
that's what we got.
Yes. And so people are eating a lot of interesting snacks.
Junk.
Yes. Although I must say you made something wonderful last night. One of my favorite things that you make taquitos, which are really good. The corn tortillas.
Yeah.
He makes corn tortillas with, and for me, I'm avoiding dairy right now. I don't know if I 100% need to avoid dairy, but I'm doing it right now. So he uses, plant-based pseudo cheese for me and some beans and some chicken. And it's wonderful. And we dump a bunch of avocado in that and they're really great. And he is eating dairy. So his has actual cheese and you're putting cheddar in it, right?
Yes.
So here's a funny thing about you and your cheddar.
Yeah.
So I watched a cool YouTube.
Uh-oh.
This guy
I'm
was
in trouble
hanging
now.
Out.
I can feel it.
He was hanging out with a lovely Mexican woman, a lovely woman from Mexico. And they went to Taco Bell, and he brought this traditional Mexican woman. She's a Mexican American because she had an American accent, so she must have been living in the U.S. But he took her to Taco Bell and said, "Okay, what is all this stuff authentic?" And you can imagine what she said. She said, "All right, hard shell tacos are not a thing in Mexico."
No.
No.
No, they're soft.
No, they're always soft. And taco and burritos are Tex-Mex. They're not Mexican. They're not traditionally Mexican. And flour wraps made from flour, from wheat flour, are not Mexican.
Mm.
That when you get any kind of a tortilla in Mexico, it's going to be made from corn. Also, the Mexicans are very particular about their corn. Guess what they don't like their corn to be? GMO.
Oh, right.
Yes. Yeah. So they're working on banning GMO corn completely in Mexico because they do source a lot of their corn from the U.S.
Do you know what else they don't like? They don't like their Coca-Cola or soft drinks to have
high fructose corn syrup in it. That's right.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
Funny, huh?
So if you go to Taco Bell, that she just kind of laughed at all the different offerings of Taco Bell and said, "This is not a thing. This is not a thing." That crunch wrap that they have, that's not a thing. She said, and also getting a dish where you have a couple of enchiladas are Tex-Mex as well. They're not traditionally Mexican. Burritos, enchiladas, hard shell tacos, Tex-Mex, not really authentic Mexican. So I found that very interesting. The other thing she said, which is where I was coming after you, is you would never see cheddar cheese. They don't use cheddar cheese in Mexico.
They use Mexican cheese.
Yeah, they use that Mexican queso fresco or, different kinds of...
Yeah, it's a mixture of like a Colby and there's different things that are
traditionally Mexican, yes.
Yeah.
And why wouldn't they use cheddar? Well, think about it. Where does cheddar come from? Cheddar is a place in England.
Oh.
Yeah. Okay. So they're not going to be using cheddar.
I don't know.
We use cheddar because we have it. And that's what we're used to using, but they would not use such a heavy cheese and they wouldn't smear everything in the amount of cheese that we have. Also, so that was very interesting. And then this gentleman went with this nice Mexican lady. They traveled to Mexico City and they went to Mexican fast food. It was a chain in Mexico City and they went there and you saw the offerings there and it looked kind of like any fast food place, except that the portions were a lot smaller.
Yeah.
And you know how when you go to a Mexican place here, you might get your couple of enchiladas and you're going to get sides. You're going to get a bit of rice. You're going to get a bit of refried beans. And you might get some salad with it. When you order a taco at a Mexican place, you're going to get a taco.
Right.
And that taco is going to probably have some beans on it, maybe some veggies. It's going to have whatever meat goes on it. They generally don't use ground beef.
No, they don't.
I think
they
use chicken or they
like pork also.
Right? Yeah. Yep. And they might, and chicken, it's probably going to be shredded. Right. Yep.
And it is shredded.
Yep.
And there we have a couple of places in town that are more really good. Yeah. One which has like just really wonderful tacos that are just stuffed with and inexpensive.
Because we have actual Mexican people in Willimantic.
Real Mexican people making
tacos. Yeah. So that's very interesting. So when you get a taco is not this folded up thing that's hard. It's a flat corn tortilla and all the tortillas. But having said that, there are also tostadas. And tostadas are what we think of as those nacho chips. And you might get these big pieces of tostada, which you could then dip into sauces. And you could dip it into red salsa sauce. And you could dip it into green salsa, which is going to be made from tomatillos, which are the little green tomatoes. And that's going to be spicy. So that's what you're more likely to see. So I found that very interesting. So, yeah, you're not going to be using cheddar cheese on your... The taquitos that we have are somewhat authentic, except yours not so much, because I have, you know, vegan cheese, and you have cheddar.
Well, what I had, just to clarify this, what I had was I bought a prepackage of Mexican cheese. It wasn't actually cheddar cheese. But
you said it was Colby and something else?
Yeah, there's a few other cheeses there. Right. What is Mexican cheese? Okay,
yeah, Mexican cheese is going to be queso fresco and some other stuff.
Right.
So you could look that up. All right, so that was interesting. Anyway, big shout out to Eleanor for writing in and giving us a great question to talk about. And lots of people are interested because I have many women. Actually, I have women and men who come in diagnosed with osteopenia and osteoporosis, and I have to assist them with that. Other things that people might be given, as I said, you might be offered bisphosphonate drugs, and the bisphosphonates might be oral and they might be injectable. And the injectables might be weekly, and the injectables might be twice a year, and the injectables might be once a year. And they make me very nervous, especially the injectables, because once they're on board, and you can't get them out. When you take a this mild Monterey Jack, again, that's a Tex-Mex thing. Quesadilla is not really a Mexican thing either. I mean, that's a Tex-Mex thing, and it says Sargento Queso... cheddar that's not authentic Mexican cheese.
Right. And then there's different ones depending on what
it's sort of Tex-Mex. And Tex-Mex is delicious, don't get me wrong. All right. So going back to what was I talking about?
I hadn't
moved on to the next thing.
I messed you up.
Right. That's okay. So we were talking about pharmaceuticals. So what you might be offered is you might be offered a bisphosphonate, but bisphosphonates do, like bisphosphonates like alendronate and risendronate, what they do is they increase the activity of the osteoblasts and decrease the activity of the osteoclasts. The problem with that is that your bones are dynamic tissue. And what that means is bones are constantly remodeling. They're constantly taking on minerals and letting go of minerals. And any minerals that are around, so if you encounter some unfortunate minerals in your life, if you encounter some mercury from some fish, or if you encounter some lead from your water, or unfortunately from your bowls, if you have painted bowls, they could have lead in them, your body will take them on and it will deposit them into the bones, and the osteoclast will eventually get rid of them. So if you block the activity of the osteoclast, what happens is the osteoblasts are increasing their activity. They're dumping minerals into the bones, calcium, magnesium, boron, manganese, copper, zinc, all the things you need to build your bones, plus anything else that's around. And because your osteoclasts are not functioning as well, it's not offloading the bad stuff. And so over the course of 5 years, you are going to get a better bone density test, but the quality of your bone goes down, which is why they generally take you off bisphosphonates after 5 years. Because what happens after 5 years, you're more likely to get fractures. And also your risk with bisphosphonates of getting a jaw fracture are higher, getting jaw necrosis. And so if you're on a bisphosphonate, your dentists often don't want to work on you, or you have to sign a waiver, or there's certain things they can't do, like you can't get a dental implant if you're on a bisphosphonate because they're afraid they're going to break your jaw. And so I try to keep people... again, this is, you have to talk to your own doctor and make your own decisions, but I try to keep people away from bisphosphonate drugs if at all possible. The other thing about bisphosphonate drugs is they give indigestion, and I have patients who come in, I'm on this bisphosphonate, I have indigestion, what, help me with my indigestion? I'm like, well, I can do all kinds of things for you, but if you can take that bisphosphonate, it's this removing obstacles to cure thing, you know, and removing obstacles to cure is a big deal in naturopathic medicine. And I find myself at least once a week, if not more often, maybe daily, talking about this very, very basic principle of naturopathic medicine, removing obstacles to cure. So one of the examples of removing obstacles to cure that I talk about all the time is when people come in and they're diagnosed with heartburn and reflux. As soon as somebody's diagnosed with heartburn and reflux, one of the first questions I ask them is, how much coffee are you drinking? Yeah. And so the answer is usually somewhere between one and a pot. And right. And so people drink a lot of coffee. And I just have to wonder how often the gastroenterologists are asking their patients how much coffee they're drinking, because coffee is directly a GI irritant. Coffee is not necessarily a bad thing. If coffee doesn't bother you, it's a good thing. If the caffeine doesn't bother you and it doesn't bother your stomach, you can drink coffee. My preference is that you drink organic coffee, because then it's going to be good quality. It's going to be sustainably sourced and fairly traded. And it's also going to not have pesticides and chemicals in it. And it's going to be grown on the forest floors of the jungles instead of being grown in big irrigated fields. When you grow coffee in irrigated fields, then you have to spray a lot of pesticides on them and you have to irrigate, and it's a waste of water. When coffee grows very nicely on the rainforest floor, and then you don't do anything to it. You just grow it on the rainforest floor and then you harvest it and you're good. And you don't, no chemicals, no pesticides, no nothing. Coffee has wonderful antioxidants. It's really good for blood sugar stabilization. It's helpful for people who have type 2 diabetes. It's helpful for clearing your liver. However, if you have a medium to slow functioning CYP1A2 enzyme in your liver, you're probably not going to do well with the caffeine. And if that's you, you're going to be more likely to get heartburn, reflux, jitters, anxiety. I have people too come in with anxiety. And one of the things I ask them is, how much coffee are you drinking? And it turns out they're consuming some level of coffee, green tea, black tea. And if they're anxious, I'm like, can you get off the coffee? And this is what I hear. It's only one cup a day. Mm-hmm. And so people don't think of caffeine as a drug, and it is most definitely a drug. And so they think of it as a beverage, and it is a beverage, but it is also a drug. And if you have any condition that can be aggravated by caffeine, doesn't it make sense to at least do a trial of getting away from that substance to see if you get better? And I don't tell people, you must get off this substance or else, because I'm not your mother. I'm not in charge of you. I'm not the boss of you. I'm giving you advice. I'm trying to make sense. It's not you have to get off coffee. It's if you get off coffee, your anxiety may get better. If you get off coffee, your GI inflammation may improve. So you can make a decision. The power is in your hands to make that decision. The other thing is, I don't want to never drink coffee again. So what I need to do is figure out, how can I drink coffee and continue to be happy and healthy? And right now, since I'm healing some inflammatory stuff in my body, I'm drinking virtually no caffeine at all. And what I've basically figured out is that in order for me to drink caffeine, I have to be getting cardio exercise. And right now I'm sticking with all exercise increases your cardiovascular rate, but I'm sticking with resistance training, yoga, and Qigong right now. So I'm not doing any caffeine. And it's amazing how well I'm sleeping, and it's amazing how calm I am. And we had a stressful situation in the office recently, and my staff was blown away about how I breezed through it. I just said, okay, let's try this and this and this, and then we'll take care of it. And they were like thrilled. So it's really amazing how you don't realize that these things affect you. So doesn't it make sense to take, now people are very attached to their coffee. They really, it's kind of a blankie. And part of how it's a blankie is because it tastes so good. It smells so good. It really wakes you up. And they are addicted to the properties of the caffeine. So people are reluctant to give it up. But it can be a worthwhile thing to make a decision to take it away for a while, see how you do, and then figure out how often you can have it, really, really enjoy it, and not have the symptoms that you have. I mean, if you have anxiety and you have heartburn, it's really worth thinking about doing a trial of no caffeine. And that's just one example. It's kind of like the metaphor I use is standing in front of the train. You're standing in front of the train, you're going to let the train hit you. And then you're going to go, Dr. Fran, what can I do about my bumps and bruises and fractures now that I've been hit by this train? And my answer is, well, wouldn't it be better if you just didn't stand in front of the train in the first place? That's removing obstacles to cure. A gentler one would be, I'm walking on this path and there's a boulder in the way of my path. So I'm going to climb up on this big boulder and then I'm going to fall off it and I'm going to get hurt. Wouldn't it be better to get the town or you, a bunch of friends, to move the boulder out of the path so you didn't have to walk over it in the first place? That's removing obstacles to cure. Very important metaphor. So if there's something in the way of your health, my opinion is it's easier to take something out of the way of your health and see how you do. And if it's something that you really enjoy, then figure out how much you can consume or take part in and still be happy and healthy. So that's removing obstacles to cure. Mm. All right. Okay. So thanks to Eleanor for writing in. So the other thing that you might be offered when you have bone density issues, you might be offered hormone replacement therapy. So if you take estrogen and progesterone in a dose that works for you, estrogen and progesterone together can help you to rebuild your bone density. And so some people will choose to do that. And my understanding is that if you take estrogen, first of all, it's a good idea not to take conjugated estrogens because they're extracted from horses and they're not meant to be in our bodies. You get estrogen that is bioidentical to us. So if you get plain estradiol or you get estradiol blended with estriol, even better. And then you pair that with progesterone. If you pair estrogen and progesterone, so if you take estrogen straight up and you don't take any progesterone, people think, oh, I don't have a uterus. I don't need the protection from uterine cancer, but you can get other reproductive cancers. So it's a good idea, and you can get breast cancer if you take estrogen without also taking progesterone. If you have a higher family incidence of having any reproductive cancer, whether it's uterine, breast, or ovary, it's probably not a good idea to take any kind of hormone replacement therapy. If you don't, and you take estrogen paired with natural progesterone, there's no additional risk of breast cancer beyond the general population. So if you have a very low family history of breast cancer, like there's no family history of breast cancer, and you've never had breast cancer, and you want to take estrogen progesterone, your risk is probably very low. Again, this is something you really need to discuss with your prescribing doc, whether it's your gynecologist or your endocrinologist or your PCP. Don't take my word for it. Discuss it with your doctor. So that's something else that is done. Okay. All right. So the next thing. So you can ask me question number three, which is going to be no fun, but you can ask it.
Yeah. What's the latest on Omicron? COVID-19 variant.
Do we have to?
Well, we don't have to, but I have heard that it's going down in some parts of the country, albeit our part of the country.
Yes, it is going down. I don't know what the latest positivity rate, the last I heard was 16%. It had been at an all-time high of 24.5% positivity rate, and it went down to 16.
The thing I heard on the radio this morning is it's falling as fast as it rose.
Right, that's now. Good.
So it just we're over the hump of the surge. That's in this part of the country. But then there are other parts of the country that are, like, down south, it's a mess.
Still?
Right, yeah.
There's a lot of country, a lot of states where they're having overflowing hospitals and high positivity rates, and it's spreading. Well, the problem with Omicron is Omicron spreads, like, insanely well. That's the problem. So here's what Ron and I decided not to make our yearly winter trip to Florida to see my mother. So in terms of us protecting ourselves, we made a decision to not do that. We are not entirely hunkering. I'm hunkering down more than Ron is. Although I do go to work every day. I work in my office. The thing is, when I'm in my office, when my actual office where I see patients is a very large room. It has a HEPA filter in it running at all times that's rated for a higher area than the space that's in that actual office. So I've got a HEPA filter pull, and it's in between, and I sit 6 feet away from my patients, which sometimes they're not thrilled with, and they ask if they can sit closer. And I have people who are hard of hearing who ask if they can come closer, and I have to say no. So then I have to project. So sometimes my staff will hear me say, you know, doing my consult, and I'm speaking very loudly, and that's because the patient is hard of hearing and they don't have great hearing aids.
You should try projecting because, well, you do have a mask on. I've got like a bunch of people in a big open room that are riding on spin bikes, and I'm projecting through my mask.
Yeah, that's a good time.
It's a really good time.
Yeah. Yeah, so right. So I've got the mask on, and people who are hard of hearing, they can't see my mouth, and sometimes it helps to see my lips and they can't, which is unfortunate. But it is what it is, because what are you going to do? So that office, I'm pretty confident that so far I haven't caught COVID, so it must be working. And, you know, I was doing a three-layer intensely woven cloth mask for up until January, when they said cloth masks are not—they're not worthwhile, and everybody should be wearing N95s and KN95s. So I switched over to KN95s, and that's what I'm wearing now. Mm-hmm. And we take our KN95s and we spray it with rosemary oil, which you can do if you want. So again, I'm going to give you some advice, and any advice I give you about fighting or protecting yourself from COVID could be considered theoretical, is not absolutely proven, but can be helpful. And so I was, big shout out to my colleague, Decker Weiss, who gave a wonderful talk at the NHANDECA, the New Hampshire Naturopathic Conference, who suggested spraying rosemary oil. You get some water and you put some rosemary essential oil in the water, and then you spray your mask with it, and it just gives you an added layer of protection. And you could use rosemary, you could use oregano oil, you could use tea tree, there are immune blends that are antimicrobial that you could use. And you could also use silver. If you have some sovereign silver spray, you could use that. You could also use There's silver nanoparticle spray that you could use, and you could spray your mask with that as well. And the nice, if you don't want to smell rosemary, the essential oils bother you after a while, you could consider using the silver spray because it has no odor. So that's one of the things that we do. And we switched to KN95. I haven't never gone out with an N95 mask because those are more intense, but the KN95s, I've come to tolerate. So, and because they have that sort of duckbill shape, they're not, you know, plastered against your face, so they're not too bad for breathing. So understand, you do want a well-fitting mask because you want that filtration all around you. But remember, part of why you're wearing the mask is to filter the air. And that's why it's okay to be able to breathe in them, because when you breathe in, it's filtering the air that comes in so that viruses can't get to your nose. Which is why it's a good idea, if you're wearing the same mask all day, to spray it with something antimicrobial, so that, and inside and out, you want to spray the outside of it as well, so that you might be able to kill some viruses on there. All right, so we're protecting ourselves that way. We haven't been gathering indoors with friends and family lately. Usually this time of year, I'll go down to New Jersey to see my nephews for two of the boys' birthdays. I'm not going to be doing that, unfortunately. We'll wait till Omicron has calmed down. And, you know, Ron is limiting himself to teaching spinning, which I'm nervous about because he goes to the Mansfield Community Center. He teaches with masks on, but again, so far so good. And he comes home and he gargles and he cleans his nose. You know, when we go to the store, we're always masked. And even though we're vaxxed and boosted, we are still protecting ourselves. So the thing is, I've heard people, like, we were watching Bill Maher on Friday night, and we saw a journalist complaining about she's done with COVID. She was a millennial age, I think, and she was so done with it, and she was talking about how there's this this culture of people, you know, there are people who are well off who are able to work from home, and they get to stay out of society, so they're not as exposed to COVID, and then people who are in society bring stuff to them. So, you know, your Grubhub and your DoorDash, and they get things delivered, and those people have to wear their masks, and they're much more exposed to, and they're much more vulnerable to getting sick. And so there's this sort of class thing going on. But this woman was, she really was like, I'm vaccinated and boosted. Why do I have to keep wearing a mask? And she's a journalist. She doesn't have a job where she has to be in the public. If I get sick, if I get a cold, it used to be you had a little sniffle, you might go into work, or you might, you know, be in your first day of your cold, you might be at work and then decide, you know what, I'm not going to come in the next day. Yep. And then when you're feeling better, even if you still had some residual sniffling, you would go back in. Can't do that anymore. Doesn't matter if you have COVID or not, because first of all, it doesn't look good. It's going to worry people if you're in there coughing and sneezing. And second of all, as soon as you get sick with any respiratory anything, it's COVID until proven otherwise. So if I get sick, I can't go to work. So I am not in the same class as that woman who she can, you know, she can journalist at home. I could see people virtually. I might have to go into the office to do it, though, and I have to stay away from my staff. And if I had COVID, I probably wouldn't want to do that. I wouldn't want to expose my staff to COVID. And so far, we've been very fortunate. Nobody in the office has gotten it, and I haven't gotten it either, and neither has Ron. Mm. So, and that's because of generally being careful. So that's what we have chosen to do. And, you know, we will probably, once the positivity rates get back into the single digits and they're reasonable, we'll probably start getting together with our vaccinated friends indoors, and you know, the weather will change and we'll be able to hang out with people outside. But right now for January, I'm spending a lot of time indoors, lying around doing indoor activities, limiting my exercise to yoga and qigong in my bedroom, and that's fine. That's what's going on. So there's one thing that is definitely known to prevent and treat COVID-19. So any advice I give you for protection is based on studies that are in progress and or general common sense naturopathic practice. Anything I say should not be construed as definitive medical advice. So cleaning your nose with nasal spray like xylitol, grapefruit seed, and salt nasal spray, and also essential oils, or using a neti pot makes sense. Gargling also makes sense, especially since Omicron has a higher affinity for the throat than other variants. People are reporting that they're getting a very bad sore throat with Omicron, which wasn't so true with Delta. And I think that's because Omicron has some common cold DNA in it. So gargling using a neti pot, it makes sense. You could use salt water. You could use salt water with tea tree oil or rosemary oil, or you can use an herbal mouthwash that has essential oils. That could be helpful too. Iodine has actually been studied to be helpful. Adding a tiny drop to a gargle may be helpful, but I would do this only with exposure, as your iodine levels can easily rise too much. And if your iodine levels rise excessively, it can affect your thyroid function. And so having said that, increasing iodine in your diet is a good idea. Iodine is present in mucus secretions. I test most of my patients for iodine levels and find them a lot of them to be low. I usually recommend increasing iodine in the diet by eating seaweed or using seaweed seasonings. You can also add seaweed to soups and stews. If you just can't handle seaweed, you can take iodine as a supplement. I like to dose low, but there are those who dose higher. For general protection against viruses and infections, I recommend at the very least zinc, vitamin C, and vitamin D. And you can take that on a daily basis, and you don't have to take a lot of zinc. You know, you can take a lower dose of zinc. It doesn't have to be a huge dose of vitamin C. Vitamin D, as I said before, you want to make sure you're running at that 50 to 70 nanograms per milliliter level, and you have to get your doctor to test you for it. If someone has an exposure to an actual virus, I would add quercetin and resveratrol. So quercetin is really nice because quercetin is a positive ionophore. It helps other substances get into cells. So it helps your vitamin C, your vitamin D, and your zinc to get into the cells a little bit easier. Resveratrol is very nice because it does have antiviral properties. It also has some anticoagulant, some antiplatelet aggregating activity. So one of the things about COVID-19 in particular is it is a vasculitis, and it causes platelets to stick together and cause blood clots. So resveratrol can help with that. Beyond that, it depends on the symptoms of each person. So for my mom, we're protecting her by not going down there. Although my mother, you know, she hangs out with her non-vax. She's not sitting around. She's hanging out with her unvaccinated or her vaccinated friends and going into what she considers to be safe situations. And every so often tells me, guess what? My neighbor has COVID right now. And it's concerning because, you know, her friends are 80 plus, a lot of them.
Right.
So,
and so is she.
She is. So here's how likely you are to catch COVID. There are situations where you're more likely to catch it. And so the thing about COVID-19 is that the viral particles, the way that you catch COVID mostly is by aerosol. So it's by somebody consistently talking, breathing, singing, shouting near you. It's not, so sitting 6 feet away, what that does for you is it makes it so that if somebody coughs or sneezes, the droplets aren't going to land on you. That is not so much how you catch COVID. If you're in a room and there's somebody who has COVID, especially if they have Omicron spreads almost as quickly as measles does, which is one of the fastest spreading viruses. If somebody's been in a room and they have measles and you go into that room, you're going to catch the measles. That's really how it works. And Omicron is almost as bad. So it comes from aerosols. So people talking, laughing, singing, breathing, water vapor is coming out of their mouth, it's carrying virus on it. That's how you catch it. And you catch it way more that way than droplets and way more than fomites. So remember how we were putting our groceries outside and letting them sit and cleaning our groceries? You don't have to do that. Mm. I think it's still a good idea to wash your hands because there is some possibility that you're going to get fomites. So when you come in from outside, it's a good idea to wash your hands. It's a good idea if you were in the store, keep some hand sanitizer in your car. When you come in from the store, then sanitize your hands. I'm still doing that. I'm touching patients all day. So pretty much at least three hand washes per patient. One before I touch them, one after I touch them, and once after I sanitize the room. So, and then if I touch the patient multiple times, depending what part of them I'm touching, I'm sanitizing even more. So, and one of my things is if I'm doing a physical exam and I'm touching the patient's feet, after I touch the feet, I sanitize. And that's not COVID. That's, I don't want to bring dermatophytes onto their upper body.
Yeah.
So that's something I do. When I get to the feet, I do as much as I can for the feet. I'm doing a full physical exam. Mm-hmm. I'm testing their, you know, I'm testing their reflexes. I'm testing, I'm finding the pulse on the feet. I'm squeezing their toenails to see if there's good circulation. And I'm testing their muscle strength, and I'm tweaking their ankles to see if they have good ankle rotation. Mm. And then after I do that, sanitize so I can touch further north, right? Okay. So your likelihood of being infected by COVID-19, so there's a nice grid here. There's low occupancy versus high occupancy. If you're outdoors and it's well ventilated, you're probably not going to catch COVID-19. And if it's outdoor and well ventilated, so that's if you're wearing a face covering and you're in contact for a short time, you're very unlikely to catch COVID-19 if you're outdoors, regardless of the activity, whether it's silent, speaking, shouting, singing, heavy exercise. If you are not wearing, if you're having prolonged content, if you're silent or just speaking outdoors, you're probably going to be okay. Once you get into shouting and singing, and heavy exercise, you are more likely to catch it. If you're not wearing a face covering and it's a short time, again, if it's well ventilated, you're unlikely to catch it. Once there's no face covering and it's a long time, silent and speaking, you're probably not going to catch it. But once you get into shouting, singing, and heavy exercise, then you're more likely to catch it. And that's outdoors and well ventilated if you're near somebody. So that's something to be very concerned about. Once you get inside, it's a lot harder to not catch it. And if you're indoors and well ventilated, once you open your mouth, whether you're speaking, shouting, singing, and definitely with heavy exercise, even if you're wearing this is low occupancy, and so this is you should know this, low occupancy, indoor and well ventilated. Mm-hmm. If you're doing heavy exercise, your chances of catching COVID are pretty good. You're much more likely to catch it. Mm-hmm. If you're poorly ventilated, it's even worse. So you're wearing a face covering. Yeah. It's low occupancy, but it's a prolonged period of time. You may have a date with COVID.
Maybe.
Yeah.
And maybe not.
Maybe not, but you're right. Maybe not, but but your chances are higher of getting it in that situation. So high occupancy, all of the rates go up and go up with the level of ventilation. If it's not well ventilated, you're going to be more likely to catch it, whether you're wearing a face mask or not. So you really want to think about whether you want to do that. So if you do a combination of things, if you gather together with lots of people in an enclosed space with poor air quality, like an underventilated gym, nightclub, or school classroom, you're probably going to catch it. If you do something strenuous or rowdy, such as exercising, singing, or shouting, if you don't wear your mask, and if you stay there for a long time, to avoid catching COVID, you want to try this table is color-coded. So you want to, so if you meet other people, do it outdoors or in a space that's well ventilated, or meet in a space where the ventilation is good and air quality is known. Keep the number of people to a minimum. Spend the minimum amount of time together. Don't shout or sing or do heavy exercise. And wear high quality, well fitting masks from the time you enter the building till the time you leave. Mm-hmm. So, unfortunately, I'm nervous about you.
I know you are.
Yeah.
But I'm doing a lot of precautionary stuff.
You are, but
I'm spraying my mask with rosemary before I go into the gym.
Yep.
Right? Mm-hmm. And I'm double masking.
Yep.
And I go single mask when I'm teaching, because otherwise I will suffocate. So I gotta at least do that. And I have taken to using the N95s.
The actual N95s, not KN95s.
Well, whatever it is, the ones that we have.
Yeah. We have KN95s and we have N95s.
KN95.
Yeah.
But it's really hard to breathe through it, I will say. It definitely makes it a lot harder.
And there are
harder.
People who are not going to spin class because they don't want to do that kind of activity in a mask.
Right.
So they're exercising at home.
That's correct. And there's a lot of people that are doing that.
So anyway... So those are the concerning things. So as of last week, the percent positivity of COVID-19 tests in Connecticut was starting to drop from a high of 24%. At last check, it was down to around 16%. This is much higher than at any other time in the pandemic, likely because we're not locked down. People are still interacting with other people. People are not necessarily wearing the recommended N95 and KN95 masks, but are still wearing cloth masks. People are wearing masks incorrectly or not at all. And Omicron is the most contagious strain we have experienced so far. Having said that, if you're vaccinated, and especially if you're boosted, you're likely to do quite well with Omicron, and it will then boost your immunity. When news spreads of a new variant, some people will not act on it, but many people will. Many will get newly vaccinated or get boosted. They'll stop socializing in close quarters with people, or will stop working or attending school in person. They'll upgrade their masks to KN95 or N95 and wear them correctly. Those changes in behavior will hasten the arrival of the peak and then drop off of the current variant. And the drop off is already happening. We're not there yet, but it is dropping off. The Omicron variant is still less likely to put anyone in the hospital, but it is more likely to put someone not vaccinated in the hospital. And even though those numbers are lower, because so many more people are catching Omicron, many people are still in the hospital. And that's taxing hospital systems. Not sure how taxed we are in Connecticut, but you're saying they are taxed in other states.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, we're not too bad here. It's really, it's going down. It's really going down.
So if you're vaccinated or have already had another strain of COVID-19, you're more likely to get an asymptomatic or mildly symptomatic case, but it's not a 100% guarantee. We're hoping that this Omicron rush will put us closer to herd immunity, and we're hopeful that this summer we'll be able to relax a lot more around this pandemic. There are people who are saying that, one of the things they're saying is that this is the last hurrah. That once we get through Omicron, you know, that the pandemic may actually be declared ended sometime this year, but we don't know. They are also talking about people getting boosted yearly, which makes me nervous. You know, that people have to get a vaccination every year. But that is what's being discussed because they're concerned that people's antibodies go down. So yeah. All right. So that was pretty good stuff. I think we have to wrap it up now.
Yeah.
We'll talk about red wine and cholesterol next week, and we'll talk about Qigong next week, which I'm very excited about.
Yeah.
So take homes for this week. Now that we know what hunkering down is and a lot of other weather response terms, we can hunker down with confidence. And then there's that Omicron. Let's hope that this is COVID-19's last hurrah. Now you've got some stuff to try. So next week we'll talk to you about red wine and things to lower your LDL cholesterol. And the warning is that, you know, drinking alcohol is not the best thing for everyone. And you can always write in with your questions. You can do that at radionaturopath@gmail.com, on my Facebook page at Fran Storch ND, or write in live while we're doing Facebook Live. And so the other thing is, big shout out to Eleanor for giving us a topic to talk about regarding osteopenia. So thank you. You've been listening to Radio Naturopath, the talk show about health and natural medicine. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician, with my co-host Ron Meniza. You can email me with questions and comments at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to this show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org, iTunes, and Spotify. You can also leave questions or comments at my Facebook page, Twitter, and Instagram at Fran Storch, ND. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. The information presented on this show should not be construed as medical advice or direction. If you are having a medical condition, please consult with your physician. Thank you for listening to Radio Naturopath, your show where you can learn about the best of science and nature. We'll be back with more Radio Naturopath next week at 91.7 FM, WHUS stores, and WHUS.org.